Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier- und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
We ran it on QI a few years ago.
Yeah.
Which was, there's no such thing as a fish.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a fish.
No, seriously, it's in the Oxford Dictionary of Underwater Life. It says it right there, first paragraph, no such thing as a fish.
Welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish. This is a special episode in which, rather than having strictly just the QIL sitting around the microphone this week, we've got two special guests. We have a comedian from Brooklyn, New York, originally from Boston, Alex Edelman.
Hi.
Who, amongst interesting things you've got going on, you've got a current text relationship with Lindsay Lohan. You once severely angered Neil Armstrong in a lift.
Yep.
What else is there? There's plenty more other stuff. Once. And we're also joined by the historical consultant from the Horrible Histories TV series, Greg Jenner, who, outside of that, if you hang out with Greg Jenner, as Alex will know, at any kind of social event, is mobbed like a rock star, basically.
Yeah.
You just have groupies. He has fans coming up to him.
Are you having a relationship with any American celebrity females?
Sadly not. George Washington's the closest, I guess, to an American relationship.
So also joining us, we have James Harkin. Doing all the fact-checking as we go along today is Anna Chizinski. And I'm Dan. So we should start by saying that this is the first time you've been to the office, Greg.
It is.
To the QI offices.
Yeah.
This is not the first time Alex has been. Alex is, you're almost like a part of the family now.
I'm going to try to cut down because I...
Well, and you're going back to America tomorrow. So
yeah.
I don't think that counts as trying to cut down.
But I'll be back at the end of this month.
Basically, as soon as Alex comes in the office, that's the end of work for the day.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, this office is like what I would like the inside of my mind to look like. Just neatly ordered and filled with facts, all categorized. Like, literally, I feel like you could find any fact in this office. Because there's a lot. Well,
there's a lot of books.
Yeah.
There's a lot of folders. We've got the internet.
And everyone's got... I was going to say technically it could just be a closet with a laptop. And,
yeah.
that would still hold true.
So, okay, well, so as this is a special one, maybe we'll start with, we'll start with you, Greg.
Oh, good, at least the third one. Let's begin with a sort of rambling incoherent.
Yeah.
I read the expert, that's what I would say.
The expert. Well, just give us what, it's your favorite thing that's kind of on your mind this week, that you've learned.
This is my first week off after writing my book, my first ever book. So
When does that come out?
I think it comes out next year.
Are you allowed to say anything about the book? Like
I can tell you the title.
Yes.
It's called 1 Million Years in a Day. Stone Age to Phone Age is the range. And it's sort of structured around a modern Saturday.
Nice. That's so great. Cool. Stone Age to Phone Age.
So I guess the groupies.
No, I thought, something I just put in the book, and I thought it was quite an interesting fact, really, is that the earliest known dentistry is 9,000 years old. This is back in sort of Neolithic, really.
It's like mammoths were walking the earth.
With dentures.
We're talking here in, I suppose, modern-day Pakistan is what we call it. It's a place called Megar, I suppose. My pronunciation's not great, but archaeologists have found teeth which have been drilled. And they've been sort of, you know, it's the earliest, really, sort of fillings or early drilling technique using a bow drill, which is, you know, just a sort of whittling bit of sharp stick. Which is a technique used really for jewelry.
So not even teeth cleaning, like, because I knew that the Egyptians had horsehair toothbrushes.
Well, yeah.
Even reparative dentistry goes back that far?
So this would be medicinal dentistry. This would be pain relief.
Yeah, I guess it's an obvious thing because people would have been in so much pain, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Although I remember reading that, like, cane sugar came in relatively late, so people didn't have as bad teeth in the Neolithic time as they have today.
It's interesting, actually. There's been a couple of major studies in the past couple of years that have shown that's not really true, actually. There's an awful lot of dental...
Wear and tear,
but also sugar-based, actually, because there's quite a lot of sugar in natural fruits and so forth. And obviously, if you're not brushing your teeth every day, it will build up. It erodes.
Is it complex sugars that really do harm, though?
Yeah, I mean, the worst dentistry in history, I think, if you were sort of elect an era, I would say probably the 18th century, the Georgians. The 18th century is where dentistry begins as a modern discipline, but it's also where, really, dentistry, like, teeth were at their worst. If you look at portraits, no one smiles.
Yes.
Yeah. Until the first ever smile. I can't remember, as a female artist, a French female artist. I think it's Lebrun, I think, maybe.
Could you check that out?
Marie right? Lebrun, perhaps. It's a really famous painting, and it's very controversial, because I think it's a self-portrait, and I think she's grinning.
Wow.
She's sort of got
and is the reason you didn't grin before because your teeth were so bad?
Your teeth were awful. I mean,
who was it who used urine for mouthwash? Was that
the Romans.
The Romans.
Wow. So it's not just me.
Romans brushed their teeth to a certain extent. They used rags. I mean, the Egyptians didn't do dental surgery particularly. They did. They were very good dentists. In fact, the first known dentists in human history, the first named dentists are Egyptian. They found, I think in 2006, I think they found a tomb with three named dentists on the wall, sort of, wow, you know, written in. So,
what, like a company name? Dentists
to the pharaohs. And they were royal dentists, so they were sort of official dentists to a pharaoh, and these three guys were clearly sort of official tooth prodders. There was a recent meta study done on Egyptian mummies. I think 40%, if I remember, I might be wrong, but I think 40% had serious dental disease.
Wow.
And dental disease can kill you.
My father's a physician, and he says something really interesting, that historically, the people who get the worst care are the famous and the wealthy. Because what he's being ironic. What he's saying is, typically, famous people have been killed by over-medicating or over-operating or too much complex treatment. Like, as soon as the body will repair itself.
We talked in an earlier podcast about James Garfield, who prodded
dirty, dirty fingers in the wound and stuff like that. My father gave a TED talk on it, which is actually really interesting. Yeah, his name is Elazar Edelman. So I wonder if those pharaohs were receiving a lot of dental attention, or B, getting such rich food that they were...
Well, that's the big question. So, yeah. the quality of food obviously is going to affect things. I mean, Ötzi, the Iceman, found in the Tyrolean Alps, he had really, really messed up teeth.
What was the fact that you were saying about the baseball player?
I can't remember his name, but it was a baseball player who was who had to be taken out of the game because he bit himself on his own ass. And what happened was he slid into the final base and his false teeth fell out and he landed on them. I'm sure you know about it.
But so what we were saying, though, is that he must have been in his 20s, right? But yet there he was with a full set of false teeth, because that was a thing that happened.
Had his teeth been knocked out?
It was the 1920s. He was called Clarence Blethyn, and he's now called Clarence Climax Blethyn. I don't really understand why.
That's his porn name.
He had a really particular gimmick.
Yeah. No teeth, you say?
Oh, Alex, I have to tell you, just as an American and a baseball fan, if you don't know this, it's my favorite baseball fact. So, do you know Lou Gehrig?
I know the disease.
Exactly.
Yeah. Should have seen that one coming.
But so this is what's fantastic about it. Turns out that Lou Gehrig didn't die of Lou Gehrig's disease. So the disease named after him, he didn't have.
There's an interesting Wikipedia list of people who have been killed by already deceased people. My favorite one is someone killed not by a deceased person, but by a deceased animal, a really notorious poacher in Montana. This is a story that people in Montana like to tell. And, like, this poacher outside of Helena, he was really famous for shooting deer, and people told him that there was one particular deer that he'd never be able to get, and he wounded it a whole bunch of times. And finally he spotted it on a bluff over him, and he shot it, and he turned around to celebrate, and the deer bounced all the way down and landed on him and killed him. And the deer survived.
Oh, wow.
The guy didn't.
We should move on to another fact.
Yeah.
Just quickly to satisfy you, obviously, Greg was right. I mean, he's a historian, about the first ever smile in a portrait. It was in 1787. There's a quite funny, the court gossip sheet at the time said, an affectation which artists, art lovers, and persons of taste have been united in condemning, and which finds no precedent among the ancients, is that in smiling, she shows her teeth. So, you know, pretty outrageous.
I saw an amazing collection of photos from a period pre-smile, where they did all the grim kind of straight face looking, and it's outtake photos where the families crack up and they're laughing, and it's so interesting because it's the first time where you see the real personalities of this
whole interesting
period.
It's really
coming
cool
through. Yeah, where they're properly laughing out loud, and clearly the person's like, well, this is unusable,
like, you don't look creepy and you don't look sullen.
Yeah.
Michael smiled.
This is such a dick, Michael.
How pleasant you look.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Let's move on to our second fact. I want to throw in my fact here, okay. Particularly because I want to hear your thoughts on this, Greg. it's a theory from a guy called Dr. Hans Ulrich Neimitz, which is that the Middle Ages never happened.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So it's a thing called phantom time theory. It's basically his alleges that it was just made up.
Are you sure that the guy is Dr. Hans Ulrich?
Yeah, I know. A lot of people believe it. You know, obviously a lot of idiots believe it. But it, according to them, 614 to 911 AD
right.
did not happen.
Did not happen.
We're going through it now.
What is the basis for this theory? This is
madness. He thinks it's a conspiracy of the calendar.
Brilliant.
And so what his suggestion is as well is that the things that were supposed to have happened in the Middle Ages, people at the time removed them from that bit of history and created a fiction of these 300 years. I think he said Charlemagne just never existed.
Wow.
As a fictional character.
So basically, half of the things that you do for a living, Greg,
yeah.
just...
My master's degree.
Yeah. is a fictional... Yeah. I'll give you some direct sort of from this article. It seems that historians are plagued by a plethora of falsified documents from the Middle Ages. Some documents forged by the Roman Catholic Church during the Middle Ages were created hundreds of years before their great moments arrived, after which they were embraced by medieval society. This implying that whoever produced these forgeries must have very skillfully anticipated the future. Or there was some discrepancy in calculating dates.
Wowzers. So where does he stand on the Vikings?
What Vikings?
Did they not burn down Lindisfarne? Did they know what happened? Lindisfarne wasn't attacked. It was just, he just didn't happen. And
yeah.
No Charlemagne. And
no Charlemagne.
Alfred the Great.
Was no just, Crusades.
He says that maybe Alfred the Great was in a different period of time. Maybe the Vikings, you know, maybe they were... Just the year before.
The year before. Yeah. So he stops at 9/11, does he?
Yeah,
9/11
he stops at 9/11. No wonder the conspiracy theorists.
So 9/11 is the year that the Vikings conquer Normandy and become the Normans. It's Rollo, King Rollo, who founds the Norman dynasty. 9/11 is the Vikings become Normans, and the Normans, of course, become William the Conqueror, and that becomes our first dynasty of English medieval kings. So 9/11 is a good year.
But this goes with the thing that you like, Dan, which is that... If you come up with an idea or a conspiracy, then you can always seem to fit in...
You can find...
...facts into whatever your theory is. And you can imagine if you said to him, what about the Vikings? He would have an answer.
He will have an answer, yeah.
But it's like numerology in the Bible, isn't it? People sort of try to find patterns in the Bible, and you sort of go, you do realise it's been retranslated loads of times.
So, all right, final question then. Is there any truth that the Middle Ages didn't happen?
I would be deeply... deeply upset.
Would
you really?
Yeah, I would actually.
But make a bit. What was?
I just kind of
staked
a lot of my life on it existing. I'd be intrigued. I mean, it's true. We should be very deeply suspicious and sceptical of the past. And one of the things that historians do is we rigorously interrogate documents, and we're always trying to disprove them. We're trying to apply that sort of scientific methodology of saying, how do we know this is true? And that's what great scholarship is, but you don't destroy all things. You're just trying to question them and say, okay. And obviously there were problems with forgeries. A monastery, for example, would be given land, and they would lose the document. And then a king would turn up going, brilliant, I'm having your land back. And they'd be like, no, this is ours, we've always had it. So they'd forge a document.
Yeah.
And then we get the forgery.
Greg,
and then
I read that, you know, Andorra, the country, they have a constitution, but it's in a safe in Andorra somewhere, and a lot of historians think that it's fake.
Really?
You heard that before?
No, I haven't. Faking what's it, like it doesn't exist at all?
As in, it's a modern reproduction because they don't have the historical basis that they think they have. Because it was one of those states that came in to buffer from the
15th century wars, exactly. The Italian wars.
If it were to be true, this phantom time thing, which is 110% not, then what it would mean is, I mean, no new scholarship is emerging, and new scholarship is emerging all the time.
Yeah, it is.
So it would be insane.
But it would also kick off our. We would really interrupt with our carbon dating.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
Yep.
Obviously, we use historical documents to try and
ally up with carbon dating, and you use carbon dating to try and ally up with historical documents. You try and play them off against each other and try and find a cross-reference. And that way, if they both agree, you kind of go, all right, maybe that's legit. And with Richard III, the discovery in the car park recently, the carbon dating there can sort of give you that specificity scientifically, which then legitimizes the documents that told us he was there.
Yes, okay.
So then we can kind of go, these docs are okay. Maybe we can look at them closely for something else.
Oh, so that's a way of verifying.
It's a way of verifying. Because you're using the scientific method to sort of say, okay, the archaeology is legit, so maybe the history's okay.
Yeah. Physicists like to use really old lead for their experiments because it's quite, it doesn't react with as many things, but that means that they're trying to use a lot of archaeological items to make their experiments. Have you heard about
that? Yeah, I've heard about it briefly. I don't know if that's... I mean, it was supposed to make sense, wouldn't it? Maybe.
Yeah. But then, yeah, it's not really great to
steal someone else's stuff. This is Richard III. Can I borrow that? I've got an experiment on. Just, you know, I need an old king.
I mentioned that James was right, that there is a theory, which, in fact, sounds quite well-founded, that the Andorran constitution is a forgery. Although this is in a book, so apparently it came from Charlemagne. It was signed at the independence of Andorra.
Know Charlemagne didn't exist.
I think we've established that.
Although I am reading it in a book where they've spelt... It's a book. It's Andorra Business Law Handbook, but they've spelt Charlemagne. Charlemagne?
He was a dog. He was a dog with a terrible...
Yeah. I don't know how trustworthy that is.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to go on to... We'll do Alex's fact now. Alex? All right,
my fact is it's about... the most medically indispensable sea creature in the United States is the horseshoe crab. Are you aware of the...
No, go on.
It's a wide claim to make, isn't it?
Yeah, how does that work?
Well, so the horseshoe crab lives in the very bacteria-rich coastline, shallow waters in the ocean. So in the early 20s, they were sort of seen as a nuisance, and they were ground up and used as fertilizer and stuff and fed to pigs. And now... Every year, 500,000 horseshoe crabs are harvested, and they're brought into factories by one of five companies all along the eastern coast of the United States, and they're bled alive, and their blood is baby blue. And if you can find a picture, it's incredibly interesting. And this blood, it detects any dangerous bacterial endotoxins, even at a concentration of one part per trillion. So the FDA requires that all new drugs that are brought to market, be run through this horseshoe crab blood. So every single person in the United States who's ever had an injection of any kind has had a drug that's been tested in this LAL test.
Wow, that's amazing.
That is incredible.
It's unbelievable. And the blood per quart is $15,000. So they don't kill the crabs. So that's like, so people
they
love
just,
that.
Yeah, they just
they bleed
take the
them,
blood.
And then they take them on a boat all the way out to sea so they don't reharvest crabs that they've already bled.
They're going
to
say, like a great holiday cruise.
You guys have done a really good thing. But they dump these guys really far out, and they notice that less and less of them are coming back. While you don't kill something when you take a lot of its blood, it does make it more lethargic and less likely to mate. But yeah, so that to me is...
That's very exciting.
Yeah, I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
That they have basically the best immune system of anyone.
They do.
We can use.
Do you know my favorite crab? Have you heard of the samurai crab?
No, but
oh,
it sounds
like
awesome.
A movie. Yeah,
this see this. It's very exciting.
Sorry, Steven. So,
basically,
they
back in the
sideways.
Yeah. There was a superstition that samurai warriors, when they died, were reincarnated as these crabs because a lot of these crabs that came up had the pattern on their shell. Of a samurai face.
That's
and it
brilliant.
And it became an evolutionary thing, so it's the samurai pattern that became the...
That is brilliant. Wow.
And so they would throw the ones that looked like a samurai back into the ocean.
That's
and
brilliant. Are there other stories of animals selectively surviving like that? Because I've always wondered...
Well, I think dogs are supposed to be a bit like that, and cats and
cats, cats domesticated themselves.
Yeah, because cats, when they meow, they don't meow to other cats, they only do it to humans.
Really?
They've selected to meow just so that we would think they're little babies, I think.
We domesticated dogs. We, you know, deliberately took wolves and went, please stop biting me. I'd like you to be a dog, please. And the amazing thing is that you can domesticate an animal really, really quickly. There was a Russian scientist who did it in the 50s with foxes. I think it was, what was his name? Things with B, I think. Biliadinov or something like that. He took foxes, feral, wild, angry foxes, trying to eat his face, and he just bred them and bred them and bred them, and always taking the most docile cubs and bring them together.
Beliaev.
Yeah.
James can pronounce this.
Beliaev.
But he bred them together so that you ended up with these sort of more increasingly docile creatures. But the extraordinary thing that he discovered was that when you breed for physical characteristics, it also creates a personality chain. They became more sort of dog-like and more sort of fluffy-tailed and more sort of willing to follow around. But they also changed...
More obsequious.
But they, yes. But they,
obsequious foxes.
Obsequious fox.
Yeah.
But they would also change their personality and demeanour and the fact they respond to calls and so on. And he did that in like 10 generations. That's all it took. You know, there's been an awful lot of genetic testing recently because we can now do DNA analysis on animals. And we found that actually dogs are much older than we thought. So
do we think that we got them for companionship or fighting or...
It's like, probably hunting and companionship. Because we had pet bear. There's definitely at least one pet bear that's been found in the Stone Age.
Well, Byron had a pet bear.
Byron
had a pet bear?
He took it to Cambridge with him.
Took it to Cambridge.
Because he wasn't allowed a dog. So he was a bit of a dick. And he turned up going, fine, I'm going to have a bear.
Is this before or after he founded the hamburger chain? Or is that... Is that the most ridiculous... Oh, wait. Someone kept a pet scorpion in a jar on his desk. I read this in one of your books.
That's Ibsen, yeah.
I read that in one of the QI books, which are available in fine bookstores everywhere.
Yeah. probably the same books as Greg's book will be available in next year.
Yes. All the shops.
Talk about obsequious.
But the extraordinary, anyway, back to this sort of dog thing, just very quickly. The extraordinary thing is we obviously domesticated dogs, because to do that you have to sort of take a wild, feral wolf that is trying to kill you and gradually tame it. But not, it's not taming, it's breeding it. You take the runt of a litter and the runt of a litter, you bring them together, and gradually you breed them and you create a new animal, and that is the dog.
Amazing.
The amazing thing is that the oldest dog breed in the world is only sort of 1,000 years old or something. Roman dogs don't exist anymore. So when you find the Roman dog at Pompeii, which we have found one, that breed no longer exists. Doesn't exist anymore.
Wow.
But
is it because they die out?
The breeding programs change and you have sort of different needs for them, and animals are constantly evolving and changing, and we breed them a different way. You know, George Washington bred dogs. George Washington bred the American foxhound. He took a French foxhound from the Marquis de Lafayette and an English foxhound, and he bred them together and created the American foxhound.
Wow.
And he was really obsessed with this. He was sort of a typical 18th century gentleman and was like, I'm going to breed an animal. But the amazing thing is cats domesticated themselves. The oldest known cat, I think, is from Shailaboros, I think in Cyprus. I think it's about 9,000 years old.
Is there any truth to the story when people attach cats to their shields?
Yes.
So the Egyptians
would... Yes, I love this. This is the Battle of, I think, Pelusium, I think, off the top of my head. Because so the Egyptians believed cats to be holy and revered. They had huge cat funeral monuments with like millions of buried cats that they would... If your cat died, you shaved off your eyebrows and you would take your cat to this holy city of cats called
Bastet. They found a load of mummies, didn't they? Mummified cats, like a million of them.
Oh, yeah, huge one recently.
Yeah.
And the city, I think, was called Bubastis, named after the... I think. I might have made that up. There's definitely a city. And they would bury the cats and they'd shave off their eyebrows.
And it's working overtime, by the way.
Sorry. I'm really sorry.
No.
Well, I never want to interrupt. So I've got 1,000 tabs up with information. It's
great. I can't wait till the end of this section.
But it's called Bubastis.
Bubastis. Good.
Right.
Okay, good. I wasn't just making up some random name. But they worship cats. And there's a famous story that a Roman soldier was in his chariot and he ran over a cat and he was killed by an angry mob.
But then in the Middle Ages, people thought that cats were evil, didn't they? And
they thought they had no soul. They thought they were witches' familiars. They used to be burned alive as well. Louis XIV, I think. But
yeah, he did
alive.
Went to a burning ceremony,
yeah,
didn't he?
And he ceremonially threw them onto the pyre.
Wow.
They used to be stoned. They were eaten alive.
Eaten alive. How do you eat a cat? There's a lot of declawing involved.
Man, you just grab it. I guess you hold out the legs and just start chomping. I don't know.
Oh god.
They've gone from gods to being evil, and now we just put them on the internet and laugh at them.
We'll be gods again, I suppose.
Yeah.
We worship kittens.
I'm going to quickly do my last little fact. I found that we have 28 people that we know slept with Queen Elizabeth I, and that they were all women.
Whoa!
What?
So what you mean, when you say slept with, you
slept
mean
in the same bed
near.
As. Yeah.
Well,
does that sound right to you?
Same bedroom.
In the same bedroom?
Yeah, same bedroom. Okay. The interesting thing about Queen Elizabeth, I actually made a documentary for Channel 5 a few years ago that was awfully ridiculous, where we sort of went, did she have a love child?
Yeah. did she, or...?
Well,
no.
there was a rumour she did, and the Spanish used it as propaganda, and obviously I don't think she did. But Elizabeth I, she probably didn't spend more than 5 minutes of her life alone. She was constantly surrounded by people. Like, everywhere she went, she was born a princess. She was always going to be a princess, and then she was a queen, and then she died.
Mm.
So you have ladies in waiting who, of course, would sleep in the same room as her, and you'd have sort of truckle beds at the bottom of the bed. Usually, they would sleep in, or
bunk
maybe
beds, like
more of a sort of a pull-out little.
Oh, like a cupboard.
Yeah, almost like cupboard. Under the beds, like little, you know. But these people
cool.
didn't really have any kind of private space.
But the queen could never go like, "I want some alone time."
Maybe, but we don't have any records for that.
And you know what else? I don't think this time period ever existed.
So what does this fact mean then? Does it mean that she slept with way more than that?
Basically, it's a way of bringing up this interesting fact that the monarchs would have sleeping partners for companionship and for safety and whatever.
Yeah. I read that Gandhi used to sleep with naked female virgins to test his chastity. So they would lay next to him in bed.
Wow.
Yeah, and just so he could be like, look how awesome I am.
Yeah.
Look at nothing. I don't want to knock Gandhi on our show, but...
I'll knock Gandhi. But, fuck it, that's weird.
No, but... Yeah. But maybe he was caught the first time by his wife.
Right.
She's like, oh my God, you're having an affair. He's like, no, honey, I'm testing my chastity.
Yeah.
She's like, you're going to... So he's like, yeah, I'll do it every night. Like,
but there's a nice story. I think it's in the Bible. You might be able to help us more here, our resident Jew. But it's King David, I think, has a woman called... Is it Abishag?
I
think she's the official human water bottle. He gets really old.
Wow.
He gets really cold.
Yeah, and just a woman that he cuddles with.
Exactly. And she's a young, beautiful, beautiful virgin, and she gets in the bed with him, and her job is to warm him up at night.
She's the one.
It has an interesting translation to 20th century care of U.S. presidents. And this is mentioned in my father's TED-Med talk, which I didn't mean to plug as much, considering it's probably only got like 20 views because it's a TED-Med talk. And it's
we'll post this talk.
Don't post the talk.
On the QI, so.
But Eisenhower had a lot of heart attacks. Just like constantly having heart
every
attacks.
Every morning.
Like, he would wake up and he would go to a doctor and the doctor's like, yeah, you had a heart attack last night. And like he was prescribed a prescription that he snuggle with Mamie Eisenhower.
Brilliant.
But that basically was his, like, it was a fair prescription for a long time that literally to have, like, a cuddle buddy...
Would calm him down.
Would calm anybody down.
Yeah.
But, like, it's been prevailing knowledge up until pretty recently that having someone to, like, snuggle... Like, teddy bears, there are some papers that in New England they used to circulate a lot because I guess New England is where I'm from. I'm from Boston. Is like, I guess teddy bears sort of started in Vermont. And, again, I'm sure a QI question is whether or not Teddy Roosevelt...
Yeah, we think so.
Do you really?
Yeah, do you think?
The teddy bear Teddy Roosevelt thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 1903, isn't it? Yeah. And he refuses to shoot a bear, is that right? He's hunting and he refuses to shoot it.
Yeah, and Kermit Roosevelt was the first Westerner to shoot a panda or something stupid like that.
Really?
I might be wrong about that, so.
Just to interject, it wasn't just Kermit, it was Kermit and Theodore, Teddy's son, and they shot the panda together. So they both agreed that
family
they both
outing.
Shot. Yeah, family outing. They both shot with their separate guns, and they both claimed to be the first Westerners to kill giant pandas.
To kill giant pandas.
Isn't that touching?
On that note. We should wrap up now. But if you want to ask any one of us any questions about the things we've spoken about today, you can get me on @TribeLand.
I'm on @EggShaped.
Alex, what are you on?
I'm @Alex_Edelman.
And this is all Twitter we're talking about, by the way.
Greg. Don't shout it into the air.
@Alex_Edelman. He will appear.
Greg, where are you?
@Greg_Jenner.
Yeah, okay. And Anna's not on Twitter, but she can be got on @Quickipedia, which is the main QI Twitter page. We're going to have a bunch of photos, I guess, and a TED Med clip up on the QI.
Oh, my father's going to kill me.
.com/podcast. That's where you can find it. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. So that was another edition of No Such Thing as a Fish. I'm going to call it special title, No Such Thing as the Middle Ages. That's going to be the... that'll be like on
thing.
The iTunes thing.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Catch you next week.